WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. What tops the list of what Facebook's 1.2 billion users are talking about? Who, in a summer survey by Twiplomacy, was deemed the most influential man on Twitter? Who, according to Global Language Monitor, was the most talked about man on the internet? Who gets coverage in Gawker and GQ? Still don't know? Well, who was just named Time Magazine's Person of the Year? Come on, who loves tango and sinners?
No, the real question is, what religion has the stone-cold coolest leader?
Wait, don't tell me is Peter Sagal is making it too easy.
It was a thrill for the crowds. Pope Francis walking out on the street to press the flesh.
The embrace that has gone viral. Pope Francis laying his hands on a disfigured man.
Interview, Pope Francis blasted church hardliners for focusing on small-minded rules that are divisive, like abortion, gay marriage, and contraception.
I am not exactly sure what this pope wants, but I'm starting to fear it's my time slot.
He has garnered larger crowds in 8 months as pope than Benedict XVI had his entire 7 years as pope. That's gobsmacking.
Rocco Palmo writes the influential blog Whispers in the Loggia.
You know, someone who is very serious, very dour, as Archbishop Buenos Aires, has suddenly become this wildly charismatic figure. The Argentinians who have spoken to him since his election said, basically, what's gotten into you? He said, at the moment of the election, something just came over me and it hasn't left. That's a direct quote that's been passed along from him.
Did he say what it was?
Catholics believe that the choice of the Pope is determined by the Holy Spirit. And having spoken to electors who were in the conclave, some of whom were in the last conclave in 2005, once they went in there, as several have said to me, and they've used these exact words, something took over the place.
Wow.
A supernatural experience happened. And those who were in the conclave in 2005 said that it was unlike anything that happened even last time.
People are willing to believe almost anything about this pope.
Daniel Burke co-edits CNN's Belief blog.
The one about going out to the poor went viral, even though it wasn't true. People at the Vatican have told me just no way that he can do that. But they seem like something that he would do.
So when we call Pope Francis the internet pope, it's not that he does his own coding, right?
No. This pope knows a lot of languages, but I don't think HTML is one of them. It's more like stories about the pope tend to go viral than the pope himself kind of conceiving some master plan in the Vatican to get everyone to retweet him.
So how much of this is real and how much of this is papal brand management?
Well, it's clear from the pope's writings that he knows what he's doing. He has a plan in mind. He famously named himself after Francis of Assisi, the guy who wears the long brown robe and always seemed to have animals around him. And one of the most famous statements attributed to St. Francis is, preach all the time, use words when necessary. And I think that this pope has really kind of taken that as his motto. He knows the power of these viral images, but that doesn't mean that he's not sincere when he does this. I mean, when he, for instance, embraced and kissed the man whose body was unfortunately covered with boils, he didn't like look at it in his Vatican calendar and say, hey, I'm going to do this today. He didn't know that guy was going to show up in Vatican City.
On December 4th, the Pope tweeted, quote, 50 years ago, Vatican II spoke of communications. Let us listen to, dialogue with, and bring to Christ all those we encounter in life. In fact, comparisons with Vatican II come up a lot, and it's not unreasonable to suggest that this may be the era of Vatican 2.0. A half century ago, Vatican II was the product of another elderly man of humble birth and abundant good works, whose coronation induced a seismic shift. Pope John XXIII actually did sneak out of the Vatican to walk the streets, as Francis is rumored to have done. John was the first pope in nearly a century to make pastoral visits to Roman hospitals and reformatories, as where Francis later washed the feet of juvenile inmates. In 1870, the First Vatican Council was tasked with defining church dogma in the face of the growing influence of rationalism. It formally declared the pope infallible. So why convene a second council when all questions were answered by infallibility? But in 1962, the Second Vatican Council aimed to correct an endemic failing, to turn an ingrown church outward by encouraging Mass in the vernacular, reasserting the power of bishops and the laity, fostering friendly relations with other Christian and even non-Christian faiths. Jews would no longer bear collective guilt for the crucifixion, and religious liberty was declared a human right. Interestingly, so was access to information. Both producers and consumers of media had a responsibility to be both truthful and moral, but the decree explicitly extolled the power of the press, movies, radio, and television, especially for spreading the gospel. This embrace of media technology and this call for social communication was new. Television was just getting off the ground in much of the world. It's often said that the piano that could truly convey Beethoven's music wasn't invented until after his death. Vatican II could write the music, this call for social communication, this emphasis on the world outside the church, but it didn't have the piano. Francis does. It's called global media. Rocco Palmo.
Francis is the first pope to have been ordained a priest after Vatican II ever. And so basically, while the church has spent the last 50 years since Vatican II fighting over the outcomes of Vatican II, for Francis, he was ordained after Vatican II. He was formed in that church. It's all a settled question.
Last month, in his landmark papal manifesto, Evangelii Gaudium, what one commentator called his I Have a Dream speech, Francis wrote, "I prefer a church which is bruised, hurting, and dirty because it has been out on the streets, rather than a church which is unhealthy from being confined and from clinging to its own security." Sounds like Vatican II. And so does this quote. "If one is an extreme necessity, he has the right to procure for himself what he needs out of the riches of others." Oh, wait, that was Vatican II. What Francis wrote was, quote, "Just as the commandment, thou shalt not kill, sets a clear limit in order to safeguard the value of human life, today we also have to say, thou shalt not, to an economy of exclusion and inequality. Such an economy kills."
Today, while visiting one of Italy's poorest areas, Pope Francis denounced what he called idolatry of money in big business.
"Somebody has either written this for him or gotten to him. This is just pure Marxism coming out of the mouth of the Pope."
Rush Limbaugh wasn't the only one who groused. The Pope's remarks about the tyranny of unfettered capitalism and the Church's fixation on issues like gay marriage and abortion make conservative clerics and commentators cringe. And even some on the left flinch when he remarks on the role of women.
He tries to be nice.
Maureen Fiedler is a longtime activist within the Church and host of the public radio show Interfaith Voices.
He uses all of the positive stereotypes about women when he tries to describe us. He talks about women's sensitivity and intuition and distinctive skills like their special concern for others. Well, these are qualities that we share with a lot of men, himself included. He seems to think women are somehow a different species of human and puts us in a different, almost metaphysical category from men. And from there, of course, he goes on and ratifies the old decision not to have women ordained to the priesthood.
Nevertheless, Fiedler credits him with ushering in an era of welcome and inclusion.
And as he tries to do that, as he talks to more and more people with different perspectives in the church, it's very possible that he himself is open to change and that some of what he's putting out bespeaks a kind of interior wrestling within himself over some of these questions. At least I hope so.
I think that attitude change, that way of kind of saying, let's sideline the culture wars, that's huge.
CNN's belief blogger, Daniel Burke.
He wants to kind of break that mold and say, hey, you know what? We need to go back to fundamental truths. What this church is about really is serving the poor, spreading the gospel,
strengthening the bishops and the laity, emphasizing social justice, reaching out to populations formerly shunned. It all goes back to Vatican II. Add to that his action to reform the Vatican Bank, and finally, a week ago Thursday, to convene a special commission of priests, nuns, and lay people to expose and address the Church's deepest shame, and you have a man engaged in a millennial ad campaign for Christ.
He knows that the sexual abuse crisis, it's the worst scandal the Church has faced in centuries. I mean, let's be honest, it was front page news for years, decades. And so he knows that. And so in some ways, in the corner of his mind, he's got to know that going out there and showing this different face of the Church, the face that hugs people who are disfigured, the face that washes the feet of juvenile delinquents, the face that is embraced by huge crowds in Brazil during World Youth Day, he knows that if people are writing about that, they're not going to be writing about sex abuse.
So partly it's a distraction?
Distraction implies that it's insincere, which I'm not sure that it is. I think that it's a way of, as our political friends would say, changing the narrative. But I think he sees it as kind of a rebalancing that, you know, the Church has done these terrible things and it has to own up for them and it has to treat the victims well. But that's not all the Church is known for.
The Pope will keep us focused on his good works and his good cheer. John the 23rd brought the world in with a vernacular mass. Half a century later, Francis presides over a tango mass, which you're hearing now. Like Pope John, Francis communicates charity, dignity, and tolerance. But he does it through viral photos, Facebook posts, tweets, and the tango, preaching all the time, as his patron saint advised, using words only when necessary.
Please, pray for me. I need it. I promise to pray for you. God bless you. In the name of the Father, of the Son, of the Holy Spirit.
Coming up, the White House message machine rolls over the press corps and the selfie seen around the world.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. On the Media is supported by Next Issue, providing unlimited access to popular magazines like The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Time, People, Wired, New York Magazine, Vanity Fair, and over 100 more, all for a single price. Listeners can read as much as they want, all in one convenient app, and can try 1 month free at nextissue.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week's memorial service for Nelson Mandela was a font of headline-grabbing photo ops. First, there was the handshake between President Barack Obama and Cuban leader Raul Castro. Here's CNN's live coverage of that.
Before I came on, we were walking around and talking to security officials.
He's shaking hands with Raul Castro.
As Christian points out, President Obama just shook hands with Raul Castro from Cuba.
And all the subsequent Kremlinological commentary culminating in Senator John McCain's penetrating historical analogy.
Neville Chamberlain shook hands with Hitler.
Up on the podium, there was the sign language interpreter who later explained that he was hallucinating angels and had past episodes that resulted in violence, flailing his arms about, signifying nothing.
He was seen behind President Obama and a number of other speakers making hand gestures, and critics have said that he was an imposter, that none of this made any sense.
And finally, of course, there was Selfie Gate, the funeral selfie scene around the world featuring the smiling trio of Obama alongside British Prime Minister David Cameron and Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt.
Is this modern-day diplomacy, or is it just disrespectful at a memorial service?
Roberto Schmidt, the AFP photographer, took the picture of the selfie being snapped. Tell me about the events leading up to that moment of that picture, the context.
Well, part of my assignment was to look at the heads of state who had gathered for the ceremony. Barack Obama, was talking to David Cameron and with the Danish Prime Minister, and that's when she actually reached into her purse and brought out a cell phone and stretched her arms and did a selfie with him. I actually like the fact that I was seeing this, seeing dignitaries on a human side, which we rarely get to see, actually. You know, nowadays, the access that we have to dignitaries is so controlled that I thought this was actually refreshing.
Did this strike you as shamefully disrespectful?
Not really. I think this whole episode has been blown out of proportion. It was a very festive atmosphere, which is actually very interesting and pretty, actually, in a way. It's the way South Africans celebrate the life and the memory of Nelson Mandela. And they were dancing and singing.
And laughing.
Yeah, absolutely. A festive atmosphere.
The ceremony had already gone on for 2 hours. It was going on for 2 hours more. It was just one of, what, some 500 pictures you took of the event?
Yeah, that's what's a little bit sad about it. We put out close to 500 images that day. And some of the images are very, very interesting, nice, strong images showing this celebration for Nelson Mandela. And unfortunately, you know, the picture that got most front pages in dailies and websites around the world was the selfie.
Aside from some people's moral indignation seeing this photo, there was also a little mini-drama involving a floating image on social media and even some news outlets that showed a series of pictures of Obama sitting in between the smiling, blonde Danish prime minister and a rather glum, sullen-looking Michelle Obama. Were we seeing a domestic spat?
I think that's an interpretation that people are making, but just one single image can be a little bit deceiving sometimes. At the moment that the picture was taken, sure, she was serious and she wasn't partaking in the selfie. She was just looking forward. But, you know, minutes before, she was meeting, greeting people, talking candidly with others. Look, whatever interpretation you want to make, you should ask her. I cannot say.
There was a report from Media Matters this week that said a majority of Mandela's memorial coverage on the cable news channels focused on the Castro handshake and on the selfie rather than on the memorial itself or Mandela's legacy. Did you ever imagine when you snapped that photo that it would become such a big deal?
No, never. I knew I had an interesting moment just because we usually don't see heads of state in a very human light. Everything is very staged. And I knew it was a picture worth putting on the wire and it would get some play. But I never thought it would grow into this buzz.
What was your reaction to the media spectacle around this seemingly innocuous snapshot?
I really think it's just sad. I mean, it's what does that say about our society? Is that are those the things that we focus on? Sometimes we just get carried away by noise that people make, and it just produces more and more noise.
I guess we should be glad that there are so many of these little dust-ups that they fade out of memory almost as quickly as they make their splash.
Absolutely. Well, look at this is a good example. You know, the selfie, okay, made a big splash. But now today, the big talk is about the translator for the sign language. What are we going to talk about tomorrow?
Roberto, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Roberto Schmidt is a photographer for Agence France-Presse based in India.
Do you know when this is going to air live or how I can get like a copy of it or maybe a link for it?
Sure. This will be posted on Friday night Eastern Standard Time.
Great. It's just like one of these things. Really, I never really believed this was going to happen, right? And so it's more than anything else, it's like a curious anecdote in my career.
Yeah.
And maybe someday I can sit with my son and say, yeah, like, check this out, man. Wasn't this messed up, you know? Learn from this. Don't be like this, son. Don't be like this.
On Thursday, the New York Times printed a withering op-ed by Associated Press photo director Santiago Lyon, headlined Obama's Orwellian Image Control. The piece slammed the so-called transparency president for routinely excluding photographers from White House meetings and events and propagandizing through the release of idealized official images. Lyon isn't the first critic of the White House's obsessive media management. It's been a recurring theme since Obama's first day in office, when press photographers were forbidden to capture images of the president at work. As I discovered during a White House visit last spring, technology has allowed this president to achieve George W. Bush's fondest dream of bypassing the media filter. Marine One circles in the winter rain and alights on the White House South Lawn, returning from a staged event at a Virginia shipyard to gin up support for the administration's revenue proposals. President Obama decopters and strides purposefully across the soggy grass toward the Oval Office. Witnessing this extremely high-level walking are some 50 observers huddled under umbrellas and making small talk. Cameras click and whir in perfunctory unison. The return leg from Newport News to Washington No News has been duly recorded. Ladies and gentlemen, your White House press corps in action.
The White House is where news goes to die. Everything's canned. These perfectly prepared statements.
It's a prestigious job, Zoe.
It used to be when I was in ninth grade. Now it's a graveyard. The only halfway interesting thing they do is throw a big dinner party once a year where they pat themselves on the back and rub shoulders with movie stars. Who needs that?
That's a particularly resonant bit of dialogue from the Netflix series House of Cards, an inside the Beltway melodrama in which the conflict tends to be a bit more compelling than the real life version. On TV, there's lots of skullduggery and drinking and illicit sex. In the White House briefing room, it's mainly talking points.
In anticipation of the meeting Friday, the president did invite four leaders.
In the past week, the press corps' very relevance has been questioned in Slate and also in Politico, which called Obama a puppet master. Guess who are the puppets? That's what I asked CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett, although I chose the slightly less pejorative term stenographer.
The president has a message. He's the leader of the free world, and his message deserves to be communicated. That is a prerogative of the presidency. Conveying that accurately is not stenography, and I don't consider that beneath me.
The nagging question this week, though, was what has displaced him? Once upon a time, these ink-stained barracudas, whether sardined into their cramped West Wing annex or on the road with the president, represented the only way to efficiently reach the electorate. Those dynamics every now and then did result in some drama, such as the 1974 confrontation between CBS's Dan Rather and President Richard Nixon.
Are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you?
Tens of millions of people tuned into what were then all three networks gasped at Rather's impertinence. But today's reporters and photographers have been marginalized by a gazillion other channels. Twitter, MySpace, Facebook, the White House's ongoing blog, the Ask Me Anything forum on Reddit, and on TV, not much evening news, but plenty of Live at 5, David Letterman, and The View. The White House is now itself a kind of media house. Ann Compton of ABC News.
They become publishers, they become journalists, they become their own advertising agency.
Never mind one-on-ones with the president, says Compton, who's covering her seventh presidential administration. Most of the time, reporters can't even get access enough to shout out questions at a grip-and-grin session.
We don't cover Oval Office photo ops. We don't cover many of the meetings he has when he meets with people on immigration or gun violence or the fiscal cliff, the meetings with Congress. It's been 6 months since I've even been in the Oval Office on my turn to be the pool member in there. To shut the media out to the extent this administration has, I think, is a disgrace.
And when administration officials do make themselves available, the information is almost always on background, which means nobody's name gets attached to the subsequent story and no official is held accountable. For Fox News correspondent Ed Henry, the final straw came with an event entirely closed to the press. Okay, it wasn't a summit or a bill signing. Okay, it was a golf game between Obama and Tiger Woods. Nonetheless, in his capacity as president of the White House Correspondents Association, Henry excoriated the administration for Operation Zero Dark 18 Holes, a complaint that White House Deputy Press Secretary Joshua Earnest shrugged off.
Sometimes the president's commitment
to engaging with the American public means that there are some members of the White House press corps who get a little frustrated that they're not getting as many interviews as they would like. But at the end of the day, the president's responsibility is not to the members of the White House press corps. It's actually to the American public. That's not the only way that we can fulfill our responsibilities. In order to fulfill his responsibility, to communicate his priorities, the president needs to avail himself of all the opportunity to do that. And that's something that we've done with a lot of success here.
For instance, News Anchor Day. While the captive Washington press corps cooled its heels approximately 20 feet away recently, the president sat down with anchors from 8 local stations from around the country. Among them, Kevin Ogle of KFOR Oklahoma City, who didn't necessarily go for the jugular.
You know, here I am, some local yokel from Oklahoma City, getting to go up and interview the president, and we had limited time. And so there's not a lot of opportunity to ask follow-up questions, you know, or to take him to task on things.
In other words, no Nixon versus Rather moments?
No, it wasn't like that at all.
Instead, Ogle passed along viewer questions, including one from basketball star Kevin Durant of the Oklahoma City Thunder.
This comes from KD. Putting your loyalty to the Bulls aside, what are your thoughts on Oklahoma City's Thunder basketball team? You know who KD is?
I do. I've had a chance to play with him. He's a great guy. You know, his mother and his grandmother still live in this area.
In contrast, Susan Peters of KAKE Cake Wichita was fairly aggressive in questioning Obama's plan to cut tax exemptions for Kansas's big corporate aircraft industry. That's right after she handed the president a scrapbook she made of his mom's Kansas heritage. I wondered if she thought she and her local colleagues had been fully respected. Did you get the sense that they looked at you, all 8 of you, like 8 Ron Burgundies?
I don't know if they looked at us like Ron Burgundies, but I do think the administration, think they can get their message out better through local anchors than through the White House press corps. I do definitely think that.
But she jumped at the opportunity anyway. Who wouldn't?
To be honest with you, it was thrilling. It was thrilling being in the White House interviewing the President of the United States. But the national media, they not only know the questions to ask, but they have the perspective behind the questions that local reporters and local anchors can't have. I would say, you go, White House press corps. You are crucial to us. And any attempt to diminish their role, I feel, is completely wrong.
Before I left the briefing room one day this week, I ran into E.J. Dionne, inveterate political analyst for The Washington Post, PBS, and NPR. I asked him if this administration has perfected the end around.
Well, I think all presidents try to get around the press corps, and now there are more opportunities to do it. But there is still a very large share of the population that's going to get its news mediated, no matter how much we talk about the irrelevance of traditional journalism. It's still a big enough audience that they have to worry about it.
Yep, are we ready?
And with that, Dionne went into a briefing about the sequestration showdown for a handful of the press corps. On background, of course. So, no, the lights in the White House briefing room won't be switched off anytime soon. The place still plays an important role.
We think it's as many as 40,000 people will lose jobs.
But to understand how things have changed, one merely needs to look up at the podium. As Jay Carney reads scripted answers to a reporter's question, just behind him, next to the iconic White House seal, hangs a giant flat-screen TV scrolling all the up-to-the-minute headlines. The source, the White House blog. Coming up, a unicorn in the digital age, a guy who's never been online.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com. Or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On January 1st, Colorado will be the first state to allow recreational marijuana use. Quantities will be limited, underage use will be forbidden, but demand is expected to be high. A 25% tax is projected to yield $70 million for the state, with $40 million earmarked for schools. The editor of the Denver Post called legalization the number one story of the year. To that end, the paper has launched a pot page on its site and hired a full-time editor for it. Included on the site this week, articles headlined, "Pocket Hookahs Proliferate with Young Marijuana Users," sources say, "Denver Limits Pot Home Grows to 12 Plants, No Front Yard Smoke Ban," and in a throwback to Prohibition, "Woman's Christian Temperance Union Targeting Pot." Ricardo Baca is the newly appointed editor of the marijuana page, and even before the law goes into effect, he has become a human punchline.
The Denver Post this week announced that they're looking for a marijuana editor for their website. They have one. They're just looking for him.
So how does it feel to be the butt of the joke, or I guess I should say the roach of the joke?
You know, it makes sense. As soon as that leaked that we were hiring this position, we knew it was going to get picked up in some places. We just had no idea it was going to be Jay Leno and then SNL a couple days later.
So your boss says that pot will be the number one story of the year for the Denver Post. Really? The number one story?
It's definitely up there. Colorado is on the very front end of this, as you know. So we legalized recreational use of marijuana at the same time as Washington State did last November. But we're the first people to implement it. So I know Washington State is looking, and there's lots of people who are very curious about what's happening in Colorado at the very beginning of 2014.
Tell me about the thrust of your page. Will it be lifestyle coverage, business coverage? What do you predict will most preoccupy you?
I think the focus of what we're doing is culture. So we're looking at the culture of cannabis. We'll have our pot critic musing on different strains and edibles, different sodas that he or she finds interesting. We'll have an advice columnist there answering all the serious questions and all the unserious questions. I've heard of all these groups where maybe it's a group of suburban women hanging out in their backyards once a week where they just get to let loose and have a smoke. I want in on those parties. I want in on those storytelling opportunities.
If I were to walk into the WNYC newsroom half-baked and reeking of cannabis, I would probably get fired really, really quickly. I'm sure the Denver Post has employee standards that are approximately like ours. Can you do your job under the influence, and will you?
I can't, and I won't. We have the same standards as most major corporations. We all talked about this question of, do you partake? We wanted to answer as accurately as possible, and so we have wanted to be honest with our readers about my preferences since I'm going to be heading up a lot of this coverage.
How many applications do you have for the pot critic gig?
You know, we got more than 100 on that. I've narrowed it down to about 7 or 8 candidates. I told these 7 or 8 people that I want a single review. I assigned them a strain and told them what's important to me. I want color. I want personality. I absolutely want that vernacular to speak to the occasional user, to the person who doesn't know anything about marijuana, and to the people who are entrenched in the community.
I hate asking questions like this, but nonetheless, I feel obliged. There's been so much curiosity about your role, been interviewed many times. What has happened through all of this that is most memorable to you?
Well, on the way here, actually, on the way to the studio, I listened to 2 different Fox News clips that aired in the last 24 hours, and that was certainly interesting, hearing your paper's name completely shredded by Bill O'Reilly. That's something I'll never forget.
They're going to tell you what the best bud is, where to buy it, how to prune it, how to roll it. This is promoting the use of an intoxicant by the Denver Post.
What's been the best joke so far?
Stephen Colbert asked me how I was hiring this pot critic position, and I just told him a little bit about it and asked him if he knew anybody who was ready for such a job, and he said,
Yeah, I know a few people, but I need them in my editing rooms.
At the risk of harshing your mellow, can you possibly meet the expectations that the various constituencies have for your coverage?
No, and I think, you know, we want to make sure that we're covering the marijuana community, the dispensaries, the legal retail pot shops, the people who are making vaporizers out in Boulder. But we also want to cover the people who are very against this issue, the communities who have banned dispensaries from their streets. I want to make sure that those communities know that we want to be there to cover their concerns as well.
You say you have been a user. Does the Women's Christian Temperance Union and others on the anti side of this question, do they think that you're in the tank for the law and for pro-marijuana and that they can't get a fair shake?
I don't know what they think. I think that's what Bill O'Reilly thinks, given what he said this morning or last night, whenever that aired. Yeah, you know, but I've been invited on to CNN or MSNBC to be on a panel discussion, and I've just told them very frankly, I'm not here to argue for or against it. That's just not what we're here to do.
Ricardo, thank you.
Thank you.
Ricardo Baca is the marijuana editor of the Denver Post. The Post might be the first major metro paper to award such a title, but it certainly isn't the first publication to make a bet on pot coverage. High Times magazine has been covering pot and advocating legalization for 39 years. Recent pieces have ranged from an interview with former Mexican President Vicente Fox, imploring the U.S. government to change tactics in the drug war, to a post about the types of annoying characters you find in a stoner circle. With pot businesses suddenly above ground, the magazine is running counter to industry trends by actually adding advertising pages. Chris Simonek is the editor-in-chief of High Times. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Is High Times approximately the same magazine that it was when I first saw it in college in 1974?
Things have changed. We went through a long period where we covered other drugs, and then in the 80s, we just sort of came around and decided that big, flashy cocaine centerfolds are not the way to go. I think our views on marijuana have been the same throughout. We are activists. We are pro-pot. We don't really feel the need to be objective about the subject. I noticed that Ricardo was saying that he's never going to be high at work. He's never going to write stoned. That sort of objectivity we don't feel the need to aspire to.
Are you tuned up right now?
Oh, no, I'm not.
Okay. And unlike Ricardo, I guess you, for most of your history, were kind of an outlaw publication. That is to say, what you were advocating for was illegal in almost every jurisdiction where High Times could be read. Do you still see yourself as an outsider, or are you waking up in the morning to realize, oh my God, I am just so mainstream?
I don't know. We have certainly been an outlaw publication. To this day, any issue of High Times magazine that you buy is going to teach you how to break the law.
Your original audience was principally baby boomers. Some of them are retirement age now. Have they stayed with you? Is there any AARP in High Times?
Oh, yeah. It's really hard to nail down who our audience is unless you come to our events. Then you see them, and they are old and young. They might be Grateful Dead hippie types. They might be a guy with a pierced tongue and goth metal type. I mean, a lot of guys in baseball caps and triple XL shirts. Try and include something for all of them in every issue and on our website.
Including fat, bald retirees?
Especially fat, bald retirees.
We talked to Ricardo Baca about the giggling that the company's having the position pot editor. You have been enduring that kind of stuff for your entire career. In fact, let me play you something that we found on College Humor, the website. This clip purports to take place at a High Times staff meeting.
Listen, everybody. Circulation is the lowest it has been in years. I need new ideas. I need hardworking Collins. I need like one of those mini cereals. I need milk, like 2% or 3% or 4% if they make 4% milk. If not, just take two 2% and put them together. We need ideas, guys, huh?
Upside down hair.
Yes. No. What is upside down hair? I'm talking about feature ideas, stuff we could use and write.
Is that funny to you?
You know, I could probably make a case to say the pot smoker has been hunted, persecuted, imprisoned, and targeted. It's not so funny for you to make fun of us. But on the other hand, you know, we make fun of ourselves.
It strikes me that as social movements go, High Times has been at it longer than the abortion rights people, agitating first for decriminalization and then legalization of marijuana. Mission accomplished, at least in Colorado. Is your work done?
It's far from done. There are so many people doing jail time right now for smoking, growing, distributing. Until those people are out of jail and marijuana is legalized federally, our job is nowhere near done.
So you've said you're not just declaring victory and retiring to the lake house with your favorite bong. What happens to High Times now?
We're expanding right now. As you mentioned, we went up in pages. We just redid our internet page, and in just a couple months, our Facebook likes went from 500,000 to 1 million.
Now, of course, we fell into the same trap everybody else did and found ourselves being amused with the notion of whether the pot editor should be stoking up a doobie at work. And he said, well, no, can't do it because of employment policies. But I got to guess that at High Times, there are high times. Do you ever put out the magazine while under the influence of the very thing that you're covering?
Yes. Very definitive, adamant yes. I'm not saying we go on a bender and do Jaeger shots and then put the magazine on press. We care a lot about what we do, and we've been doing this a long time. You know, it struck me there's one quote that I find very interesting and very fitting for these times. It comes from Hunter S. Thompson. When the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. And I think that's what you're seeing right now with the marijuana movement finally coming from the underground to the above ground.
Does that kind of spoil the fun? You don't get to be an outlaw anymore.
Well, I think outlaw is a state of mind.
All right, Chris. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Chris Simonek is the editor-in-chief of High Times magazine.
For those of you who have never ventured online to check it out, here's a piece from our new blog and podcast, TLDR, which brings you tales about the particularities and peculiarities of life and culture on the internet. It's hosted by producers PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman, who reported this story a while back about a man they dubbed the Unicorn.
I have just returned from an epic quest.
What were you questing after?
I was questing after a unicorn of sorts. I wanted to find a person who doesn't use the internet. I read this Pew study that said that 15% of American adults don't use the internet.
That's actually a ton of people.
Yeah, it's actually millions of people.
Huh.
Which is crazy. But then if you actually dig down into the numbers, it kind of makes sense. It's generally people who are over 65, who are low income, or come from sort of a rural area. However, I sort of wondered if there was someone like that in the city, who is maybe middle-aged or younger, who was middle class, and just kind of never plugged in.
Right. Somebody who didn't use the internet, not because they couldn't, but because they just, like, didn't see the point.
Yeah. And I found them.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you find somebody who doesn't use the internet? What do you use?
Embarrassingly, I use the internet. I sent an email to the entire radio station, and I got an email back pretty quick about a guy named Mike.
How were you picturing him?
I imagined him being kind of obnoxiously wealthy, living in a brownstone, wearing a tweed blazer, smoking a pipe, railing against how technology is corroding the society.
Wait, you imagined him super rich?
Yeah, I imagined him being so highfalutin that he couldn't be bothered with email.
Like he listens to everything on wax cylinders and like sends his friends golden telegrams?
Yeah, exactly.
So what's he like?
My name is Mike Halkias. I own a restaurant in Brooklyn, New York. Little diner.
He was a really nice 50-something guy. He moved here from Montreal. He loves Led Zeppelin. He has a mural of the band painted on the back of his diner. And he just owns a business where he never had to use a computer.
Everything is cash for me. I have a cash business. Cash goes into the register. I pay cash everything.
Also, it doesn't hurt that he's about the nicest person in the world. People seem to really want to do him favors anytime he needs to use the internet.
If I needed internet, I would always find a friend that ask him favors, and they do me anything I want. Find me a Raider jersey, find me a Montreal Canadiens jersey, find me a ticket, even a date, anything I want. People do it for me.
Also, there's this.
And in return, I do them other favors, like give them food. When I need something faxed, I go across the street to the fax place. And, of course, I give them a sandwich. They fax my stuff. Everything is great.
So you founded a unicorn. Does he know about the things that he could be able to do and isn't doing?
Actually, in spite of my assumptions that he would be proud not to use the internet and find it to be a distasteful accoutrement of modern society, he was really embarrassed that he doesn't use it.
My six-year-old nephew, he knows more about the computer than I. He knows how to get in. He knows how to play his music. He knows how to play his cartoons. He knows how to play his games. I have no idea how to do that. I feel stupid. That's what it is. And I don't want to feel stupid anymore.
So did you help him?
Well, I asked him to come down to the station and sit down in front of a computer with me so I could just sort of see what he was interested in and see if I could direct him toward all the wonderful things on the internet that he would like.
You're a salesperson for the idea of going online.
Yeah, I wanted to provide sort of an interactive infomercial for interactivity.
So what do you, I'm trying to think where I'd even, what do you show him?
Well, the first thing I tried showing him, since he's such a huge Zep fan, was Pandora.
It's like a program that allows you to pick an artist you like, and it'll try and find artists based on the one that you like. So you could conceivably just do this forever. Yeah. It's like listening to the radio, kind of, except you get to tell it that you don't want to hear certain kinds of songs. Yeah. So it's pretty great.
He sounds like he's being really polite, but he doesn't sound interested.
Well, you know, I mean, he's a big enough Zep fan that he painted a mural of them on the back of his diner. So I think that if he wants to listen to music, he'll probably listen to the Led Zeppelin discography, which I'm sure he already has in some kind of hard copy format. I don't think he needs Pandora to be recommending to him CCR or The Doors.
He's heard of those bands.
I'm pretty sure he's familiar with them. The sort of breakthrough moment wasn't from me at all. My colleague Chris Neary was in the studio recording with us, and they're both sort of diehard sports fans.
I was just thinking, how did you end up as a Raiders fan coming from Montreal?
Yeah, in Montreal in the early 70s, they showed the three winning teams in the NFL. The Raiders, the Cowboys, and the Steelers. Well, I had to be a man, so I chose the Raiders.
If you could see a play, like, is there someone you would want to see old video of?
1983, the Super Bowl. The Raiders crushed the Redskins, and I made a ton of money in college. I mean, a ton.
Okay, so let's see if we can't find some highlights from it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. This brings back so many memories. I could stay home and watch this all day, you know that? Oh, boy. Wow. Oh, he's gone. Oh, my God. Wow. He's gone. I remember like I'm watching this last night.
So at this point, you guys are still, he's like sitting there watching you guys use the computer.
Yeah, I decided to offer him the driver's seat because he is starting to take sort of plaintive steps into internet literacy. And I wanted to give him an opportunity to sort of show me what he can do.
You just move this you move the whole mouse.
The whole mouse moves. Okay, cool. And now I can click and pull down?
Yeah.
Click, and then I scroll down, right?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like he's having kind of a hard time.
He is. In fact, he was actually holding the mouse at this point with both hands, and I think that he was used to having a trackball and didn't understand that you actually had to move the whole object to get the cursor to move. But the surprising thing was that he didn't really know how to search Google.
If you go ahead and take this and move it up to right here.
Okay.
And you can search any word you want. So you can type in plane tickets, Montreal.
Wow.
And then you press enter, and it'll show you.
I'm so amazed, I can't tell you right now.
So if you wanted to search for literally anything, how about John Bonham?
Mm-hmm.
This is the Wikipedia entry. Do you know what Wikipedia is?
Mm-mm.
So Wikipedia is like the Encyclopedia Britannica, but it's on the internet.
Things that you take for granted are so eye-opening for me right now, you know?
I think in the end, he sees the internet the same way I do, as sort of like an engine for discovery. And I guess I'm a little jealous of him because I have it at my disposal whenever I want. And in a way, I've discovered a lot of the things that were amazing to me. Mm. He's going to get to see all of that stuff for the first time. So I guess I'm jealous of that lack of experience.
You know, I'm excited to find whatever I'm looking for about myself. And, you know, sometimes when you're looking for one thing, you find another. So I'm really excited. I'm going to look for music that I think I've heard it all, but there's always something that I've missed. Right now, there's going to be no missing. I'll be on the computer all night if I have to be.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Kimmy Regler, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.